You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. As the intro says, I am your host, Neff. For those of you who are joining me for the first time, welcome to the show. And for those of you who have been listening to me for the beginning or you have been listening for a while now, welcome back. I'm so thrilled that you're back here listening to me. And as promised, this is part two of the episode that I've entitled Stamped from the Beginning. As I said in the last episode, because the author really gave me some good content and different things to digest in this book, I thought it would be very difficult to get everything in about an hour and a half. So I decided to make this episode a two-parter so it could just be easier for you to digest. I have a feeling that this is something that will happen in the future, and so I'll make sure to warn you at any time this happens, like I've been doing in these episodes that I do two-parters. The funny thing is that these authors really just write so much that, you know, not only piss me off, but really make me think. So I find myself just blabbing for a while, and I really appreciate you guys just being patient with me and listening to my content. So without further ado, here is part two of this episode, Stamped from the Beginning. If you have not listened to part one yet, please feel free to pause where you are right now and go back to part one, listen to it, and then you can come back here and resume. If you do want to listen to this part first, that's up to you. But, you know, I suggest to go back to the beginning, get some more context before you dive into this episode, okay? So thank you so much. And on that note, here's part two of this week's episode. So from there, other things that kind of stood out to me was these ideas of like Black hierarchies, and especially when it comes to like classism and elitism and colorism and all these things. First, I thought it was interesting in the first few chapters where they talked about this guy named Carl Linnaeus, who he basically came up with like a hierarchy system. First, it started with like the animal kingdom and then the human kingdom, and then he kind of moved it into this hierarchy about like race, or like they kind of came up with this hierarchy about race based off of that. And it was really weird to read about how basically when they were taking enslaved Africans, they started creating hierarchies based off of that. And so Dr. Kendi says the following about this: enslavers and slave traders were creating similar ethnic hierarchies within the African kingdom. Enslaved Africans in North America were coming mainly from seven cultural geopolitical regions: Angola, which was 26%, which is 20%, Nigeria, which was 17%, Sierra Leone, which is 11%, Ghana, which is 11%, Ivory Coast, 6%, and Benin, which was 3%. Since the hierarchies were usually based on which ancestral groups were thought to make the best slaves, or whose ways most resembled those of Europeans, different enslavers with different needs and different cultures had different hierarchies. Generally, Angolans were classed as the most inferior Africans, since they were priced so cheaply in the slave markets due to their greater supply. Linnaeus classed the Khoi, or the Hottentot of South Africa, as a divergent branch of humanity. Since the late 17th century, the Khoi people have been deemed the missing link between human and ape species. So this was weird to me, the fact that they kind of took all these different groups of people from these different countries, and they're like, let's basically, like, we're not only going to commodify them, but we're going to commodify them based off how much they're, like, worth and all that. That's weird for me to see, you know, to see you do to, like, human beings. You know what I mean? It's like, I never knew that this was a thing. I guess there was literally some books and different things that were, like, published on this topic. And so that was interesting for me to read. And then Dr. Kendi talks about how a lot of these Africans kind of adapted some of these thoughts in their lives, in the sense of like, they used it as a way to kind of hoard over each other. Like, oh, I'm better than you because being sold this way or whatever. So that was interesting. But then at the same time, they resented being treated like shit because of these racist ideas. So I think that's from the very beginning, an interesting concept that you kind of start seeing, because this part of the book was like, I think during either Jefferson's side or Cotton Mather's side. I think it might have been Cotton Mather's part of the book. But it was really early on in the book where you kind of see this idea of like this black hierarchy thing is happening with these enslaved people. And later you kind of see in the later parts of the book how this hierarchy thing in the black community translates into how well are you able to assimilate into white culture, right? So it means like, are you able to like go to school, and are you well read? Are you middle class? Like, you kind of start to see some remnants of what they were doing during this time with the enslaved kind of start happening later on. So I thought that was interesting to kind of see some of the beginnings of that. And then obviously too, during the times where people were enslaved, there was this colorism thing already starting as well, where those who were products of masters raping their enslaved women, they were treated differently sometimes. They got to be like house Negroes or people that were in the house and doing other things instead of being out in the field. So of course, like, the people that were inside were treated a little bit differently than the people that were outside. Like, you were still slaves, but you kind of started seeing the hierarchy are also in that, reflected in that, even to the point where like there are people that will tell on you if you were planning to do stuff, which I saw a lot in this book, which was hard to read, where it's like, oh yeah, they planned this revolt, or they planned something, and then somebody snitches on them. It was hard to keep reading over and over again. But again, you see this idea of hierarchy, and I think it's, again, looking back at Mather's work, you kind of see how it continues to play on, how these people valued keeping this hierarchy going, because if this hierarchy collapses and we start seeing each other as equals and we start trying to build this kind of egalitarian society, it takes away from this ability to continue oppressing groups of people and acquiring wealth through this oppression, right? So that was really interesting. And then after this, I did think this, the idea around this black hierarchy thing was interesting. This topic of uplift suasion. And basically, Dr. Kendi says the following: uplift suasion was based on the idea that white people could be persuaded from their racist ideas if they saw black people improving their behavior, uplifting themselves from their low situation or their low station in American society. The burden of race relations was placed squarely on the shoulders of black Americans. Positive black behavior abolitionist strategies held undermined racist ideas, and negative black behaviors confirmed them. So learning about uplift suasion for me was really interesting, because I was like, what the hell is that? And then as I was reading about it more and more, I was like, oh, this is basically respectability politics. And I did get a definition of it by Googling it. I think it was just a website like dictionary.com or one of those things. But basically, respectability politics is a set of beliefs holding that conformity to prescribed mainstream standards of appearance and behaviors will protect a person who is a part of a marginalized group, especially a black person, from prejudices and systematic injustice. Black respectability politics embraces the illusion of a level economic playing field. Respectability politics place blame on groups already hindered by discrimination. And so I thought this definition was important to read, because again, I think uplift suasion is what it was kind of known as back then, but I also see how it's morphed into this idea of respectability politics as well. And I've seen a lot of Black people, well-meaning Black people, kind of use this idea of like, oh, well, if they behave better, maybe they would treat them better. If they got educated, maybe they would treat them better. And there's been so many examples of like what we deem as like Black excellence or all these different things. And, you know, we're still getting treated the way that we are. There's still people that are being targeted unfairly. There's still people being killed in their homes. Like, and I think there's countless examples of this where like, it doesn't matter like what you're doing as a Black person, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, you can still be the subject of a racist encounter. Right. And I mean, I could stay here all day and list examples, but we'll be here too long. But I just thought this idea of uplift suasion was really interesting because it was another moment where I was like, this is where this shit comes from. And I know later on in the book, he talks about, especially with W.E.B. Du Bois and all these different predominantly smart people were just like, oh, well, we got to do our best as a Black society to make sure we're excellent and that these whites can see that we can learn good and we can speak well and we can do X, Y, and Z. And then maybe they'll accept us. And throughout a lot of these people's lives, especially W.E.B. Du Bois, like he was still receiving a shit ton of racism. And a lot of these people were kind of seeing like no amount of like having good hair or having good features or having the right education or the right faith or the right gender identity or the right attraction to whatever. None of that was helping them receive the kindness of these white people and not be the subject of racism, right? And so I thought this idea was so interesting and so like hard to read about because I think this is where I was struggling with people like W.E.B. Du Bois, because on one hand, he's doing what he can to stop racism and try to promote anti-racism. But at the same time, like you're reading and watching him say things that you're like, ugh, that's racist. Like, and one of the biggest examples was that Dr. Kendi talks about in this book is how between him and the other like elite Black men that were educated and doing all this stuff and they're in proximity to white people, they just kept on being like, well, if we pick ourselves up and stop gangbanging and stop doing X, Y, and Z, and we go to school and whatever, these white people will treat me a certain way. So they were using this idea of like, we need to assimilate so these white people could treat us well. But again, they're assimilating and none of this is happening, right? And I know later on, Dr. Kendi even mentions like Bill Cosby and how Bill Cosby's use uplift suasion in his show, The Cosby Show, to show white people, look, like, we're all educated. Here's a doctor. I think both of them were doctors on the show. Bill Cosby and the person that was his wife on the show, I think they were both supposed to be doctors. Their kids are all going to college. Here's an example of a Black family that's doing really well and all this stuff. And of course, yes, the book notes, like, there were some white people that saw that stuff and they're like, oh, great, this is awesome. But the problem with uplift suasion is that because of these racist ideas, they only saw these people as like exceptions to the rule or like exceptional Blacks, right? It wasn't that these Black people, every Black person could have the opportunity to be this way. It was like just those few Negroes were okay and those few Negroes made it, but all the other Negroes still were bad. All the other Negroes were still not doing the right things. And that's why they were this way, right? And so that's where this topic was just so frustrating to read about. Because it's like, again, nothing you do will ever take away from these racist ideas. Like these racist ideas were just ingrained in the society. And it sucked. And it was hard for me to sit with, damn, like all these prominent people like W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, I think even like Martin Luther King, like there was a few people that were still peddling out of these racist ideas, even though they were trying to do anti-racism, right? And I think it just was a good reminder too of the fact that for a lot of us who are doing deconstruction, we do have to constantly be reminded and be on alert about the fact that whether you're trying to be anti-racist, you're trying to fight homophobia, you're trying to fight sexism, whatever it is you're trying to fight, because we are birthed and entrenched in a society that endorses a lot of that stuff every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's hard sometimes to not fall trap to what W.E.B. Du Bois and these others fall trap to, in the sense of like, we can accidentally endorse sexism when we're trying to be anti-sexist, right? Or we can actually endorse homophobic ideas when we're trying to be allies or co-conspirators with those in the LGBTQ community, right? So you're constantly having to kind of like check yourself and think about what you say before you say. And if you do say something that's wrong, we have to be willing to be like, ooh, my bad. I didn't recognize how this connected to this, and I apologize, and I need to own this and start again. And so I don't know what that would have looked like for these men in the past to do that, especially with how they were using racist ideas, especially of assimilation, to try to do what they were doing. But I thought it was an interesting thing to kind of think about, of like, damn, like it could be so easy for us to peddle some of the same filth that we're being taught when we're trying to dismantle it. It's like that whole concept of like using the master's tools to kind of deal with things, I guess, or I don't know how that saying goes anymore right now, but you know, it's like we have to be mindful not to use the oppressor's tools to kind of dismantle the system, because it doesn't make sense. Sometimes you have to really think outside of the box and start over, right, to be able to do that. And I think that's also like another scary concept for all of us to do, because like we're so used to these systems that any idea that involves dismantling the system and starting over is just so scary that none of us want to touch it, right? So that is something that I had to kind of like sit with a little bit too and be like, ooh, like, yikes. And just reading these people's words and how they were uplifting a lot of these racist ideas without even realizing was kind of rough. And so after this, I also kind of wanted to mention a little bit about these ideas around like white saviors. That was something that kind of stood out to me in this book, because there were so many moments where I was like, oh, like we were so close. Like there's so many white people that he brought up in this book that it seemed like they were on the cusp of maybe giving a shit just a little bit. But every single time that they even tried to do a little bit of change, I feel like they always went back to their racism, because it really ended up hurting them, I guess, in the terms of like their self-interest, right? So for example, with Jefferson, there were so many times where he had moments where he's like, racism is wrong in some ways, like, or slavery is wrong, I should say. It's not like he necessarily thought that blacks should be equal to him, but he started to really wrestle with the fact that slavery is wrong. But because of the fact that slavery contributed so much to his wealth, he wouldn't let it go. And I think he was a reminder of like how a lot of the time, especially with white people right now, for you to really do this work of dismantling these systems, you have to wrestle with the fact that it's going to affect your livelihood. It's going to affect your ability to have the power that you have. And so for a lot of people, including Jefferson and Lincoln and all these people that they brought up in this book, like anti-slavery, anti-racism, all the stuff was more so like lip service, because they would say the things that they needed to say to kind of get black support here and there to get where they wanted to get to. But then they would just go back to doing what they were going to do, because at the end of the day, they enjoyed having the power that they had. And so that was really interesting to read about multiple times throughout this text. And it wasn't just Abraham Lincoln, but it was like the women's suffragettes. It was Jefferson. It was a lot of the presidents that came after. And I think even current day, we're seeing how there's so many presidents and stuff that they're using the black and brown votes to basically win their elections and do what they kind of want to do in terms of like being in political power or obtaining wealth or doing whatever they're doing, right? But then when it really comes down for them to actually do what they said that they were going to do for these people that elected them, they do absolutely nothing. I mean, we're seeing that even current day with like Joe Biden and Kamala. They basically said a bunch of stuff to get the black vote, the immigrant vote, the woman vote, all this stuff. And they've been silent, even though another interesting part, too, is like both of them kind of had their career built on them hurting black folk, hurting brown folks within like their different positions in law, right? So, which is something, again, we also kind of see in these different other stories of all these other white people, is like they were hurting black folk in a lot of their policies and a lot of things that they came up with, but at the same time, they're using black folks to get what they needed too. So that was interesting to read about. But what I will say about this white savior thing that kind of killed me is I did love, okay, this part didn't kill me. I did love with the Mennonites who were Anabaptists. I did love that there was a point in 1688 where they were basically comparing what Americans were doing to people of color to what Europe was doing to the people that they were oppressing. And so Dr. Kendi says the following: Mennonites were an Anabaptist denomination born out of the Protestant Reformation in the German and Dutch-speaking areas of Central Europe. During the 16th and early 17th centuries, Orthodox authorities lethally persecuted the Mennonites. The Mennonites did not intend to leave behind one site of oppression to build another in America. Mennonites, therefore, circulated an anti-slavery petition on April 18th, 1688. There is a saying that we shall do to all men like as we will be done ourselves, making no difference of what generation, descent, or color they are, they wrote. In Europe, there are many oppressed for their religion, and here those are oppressed for their black color. Both oppressions were wrong. Actually, as an oppressor, America surpassed Holland and Germany. Africans had the right to fight for their freedom. So I thought that was really interesting that there was a group of people that were like, yo, this is really bad. Like, this is like just as bad as what was happening in Europe, and we need to change. It's even worse, honestly. And I don't know how much the Mennonites were involved in a lot of the abolitionist movement type stuff. I imagine that they probably played a big role into that. But I thought that was really interesting to see, like, okay, there were some people that were interested in like doing something and they meant well. And again, I would love to do some more research to see how they did, but that was a version of white savior that I was like, okay, that's good. Again, don't know where we're at what they actually did, but I thought that was good. And then moving on, I thought it was really interesting that Dr. Kendi talks about these abolitionist tracts that these abolitionists kind of came up with. And so as a person that did ministry for a good chunk of my life, listening or reading about these tracts kind of cracked me up, because we always did give out these evangelical like tracts to people like, hey, how do you feel about your faith? And then like eventually it led to us having these conversations about faith and all that stuff. So the idea of like people passing out tracts about abolitionist work was really interesting, right? But I did think it was hilarious what these tracts actually said. So I wanted to share about that. And so basically what Dr. Kendi says is the following: as enslavers calmly discuss profits, losses, and colonization, torture techniques, and the duties of Christian masters, they felt the spring drizzle of abolitionist tracts. By summer of 1835, it had become a downpour. There were 20,000 tracts in July alone, and over 1 million by the year's end. Presenting slave owners as evil, the literature challenged some racist ideas such as the black incapacity for freedom, yet at the same time produced other racist ideas such as Africans being naturally religious and forgiving people who always responded to whippings with loving compassion. The movement's ambiguous logo pictured a chained African kneeling, raising his weak arms up in prayer to an unseen heavenly God or a hovering white savior, Enslaved Africans were to wait for enslavers to sustain them, colonizationists to evacuate them, and abolitionists to free them. So I thought this was really funny because Dr. Kendi in this section was just talking about how these white people were going back and forth with each other about, oh, should we end slavery? Should we not? But, you know, it's profitable and we won't be able to have cheap labor. And obviously, because as much as they were saying that Africans were like the laziest pieces of shit ever, like they were really the lazy ones because these people had been doing all of the work on the farm. So if they no longer had these enslaved people doing the work for them, like they were kind of like shit out of luck. Like they wouldn't be able to have a successful farm, especially with like cotton and all these different things that they were producing and transporting throughout the world. They won't be able to do that anymore. It was becoming an issue, right? And so obviously these abolitionists became like a threat to that way of life. And they were now shaking in their boots, kind of trying to figure out what to do. And so when I was reading about these tracks, I was cracking up because I just struggle sometimes with whiteness and especially with white allyship, because just the fact that these people are like, oh, these white people will come and sustain you and help you and blah, 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 blah. It's like, I see it kind of like if I have a house and you decide that you're going to come into the middle of the night, burn it down, leave me with completely with nothing. And then you decide, oh, I'm going to rebuild this and I'm going to make it the way that I want to make it. And then I'm going to try to sell it to you. And then I have to be grateful that you rebuilt my house that you burned down. Like, I will be looking at you crazy. So that's kind of how I see some of this stuff, especially with, like, anti-racism and gringos being involved. It's like, they expect us to just be thankful for stuff that it's like, I didn't ask you to do this. And so, or, like, I'm not the one who created this system, and I'm not going to thank you for doing the bare minimum in this work. You know what I mean? And then for me to be grateful that you're part of this work, it just doesn't make any sense, because like, it's not just about you doing this work because I'm a poor black person that needs your help. It's like, this system is also oppressive to you. This system is also not good for you. And just even for the sake of like morality's sake, right? Like, it's not moral. After some time, like, I don't know, I feel like it's like being desensitized to violence. At some time, like, it's going to eat you up. It's not good for your morality that we're living in a society like this. And as much as we're trying to be so gung-ho about capitalism and white supremacy and like we're just trying to pretend it's not happening, like slowly by slowly we're seeing it like become a decay to our society. Like we're having rises in substance abuse, we're having rises in mental health issues, having rises in poverty. Like, it's obviously affecting our society in a way that is not good, but because we don't want to like look that in the face and call it what it is, like, but just it's crazy to me. So I did laugh about this. It's like these white people are like, oh, like let's create these tracks and make it look like we're so good and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, like you guys started the system. Thank you for maybe getting your head out of your ass for a few minutes and maybe deciding to get into the work of fixing this. But to now make it seem like this was all your idea and you are these benevolent people, I'm like, it also made me kind of question, like, why are these abolitionists really doing this? Because again, a repeating theme that I saw in this book is like these gringos did not want to get involved in anything until it affected them. And for them to be like, oh, no, it's because we actually want to save these black people, we knew it wasn't that, right? And so that was just something that killed me. And we do see a lot of these, the stuff that you saw in these tracks, we do see a lot of this even in like missionary work where it's like, oh, we have to go to these other countries and save them and really reach out to them and blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, no, like you guys messed up these other countries and now that you're going to go back to them and pretend to fix it. No, that's not it. And then I did love also this idea of like, oh, like these Africans are naturally religious and forgiving. I think that's something that we even see in the present day where it's like, these racist people are shooting up our kids. They're hurt and they're shooting up our schools. They're doing all this stuff. And then you see these Black people having to, they can't cuss them out. They can't do anything. They have to be like, I forgive you. And it's like a whole scene of like, oh my God, look at how these Blacks like easily forgive. And it's like, but why do they have to do that all the time? So I also kind of wondered reading this is like, oh, is this where this idea comes from? And why, you know, as Black people are still doing this? Who knows? But I did think that was very interesting. And again, I think I could be here all day just dragging like Abraham Lincoln, Jefferson, the women in the feminist movement, because all over the place, you just kind of saw within their stories, like they just use Black people to get what they need. I know this, some of the women as well in the feminist movement were like trying to push Black votes and Black stuff to kind of help their women's march type stuff. But then when they realized that Black men were going to get more voting power and all the stuff than they were, then they turned back to their racist stuff. So it's just really interesting when I was reading some of the stuff that I was like, oh, like Susan B. Anthony and some of these women were actually racist. But whatever, there's that. And then I did laugh about this woman also named Harriet Beecher Stowe and how she used like Uncle Tom's Cabin to kind of justify the work of anti-racism or abolitionism, I should say, by using racist ideas. And so she, in her book, she kind of used this idea of like saying how like Black people are better Christians because they are slaves in their domicile and white people are like the worst slaves. And that's why they make the worst Christians. And so that was part of her idea of like why we need to basically end slavery. And Dr. Kendi goes through like a whole part about this. And again, I kind of laughed reading this because I was like, is this serious? But again, for some people, this worked. But again, I just thought it was really weird and shitty to like kind of read this account of like what Uncle Tom's Cabin was actually about, because I never actually read it. And I think what really stood out to me was when Dr. Kendi said the following: Stowe's popularization of spiritually gifted Black people quickly became a central pillar of African-American identity as Black readers consumed the book and passed on its racist ideas. Racist whites, believing themselves to be void of soul, made it their personal mission to find soul through Black people. Racist Blacks, believing themselves to be void of intellect, made it their personal mission to find intellect through white people. So again, I don't know how much of this might be true of our society now, but I kind of still see like there are some remnants of that in some ways where maybe it looks more like how white people sometimes like, oh, we have no culture. It's like, no, you guys have culture. But they try to like find that with us. And then with us, it's like, oh, we have to try to do our best to like be in these high intellectual spaces with white people. And we want to like assimilate into that space, especially in academia. It's like there's this rush to like be in these predominantly white institutions. And we favor that over like being in HBCU sometimes and all that stuff. So I do kind of see that remnants of this kind of still happening without it us really reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, because I never read the book. But I know for me for a while, I kind of struggled with this idea of like, oh, I need to be as intellectual as possible and assimilate as much as possible and try not to be like an uneducated Black person or whatever. And I know a lot of this stuff is probably fed from some of these stupid ideas from this book and from these white saviors like Stowe coming up with these ideas to kind of push and rally towards like people being abolitionists, but doing it in such like misguided way. And again, I did see this with W. Du Bois' story and some of the other people that they brought up even in the Black community. So again, that was just really interesting to read. But ultimately, like I said, I think it was hard just continually reading how ultimately what moved white people to actions oftentimes was like, A, is this going to benefit me, or when is this going to benefit me kind of thing. And that was kind of annoying, especially when we think about Lincoln and how a lot of people are always like, oh, like, he emancipated the blacks and he cared. And it's like, as a kid, it was always like something that came up of like, oh, he really cared about black people and he did the Emancipation Proclamation and all this stuff. But it's like, as you read more about his story and what led him to actually do this stuff, it's not because he actually gave a crap about black people. It's just he did it as a political move to benefit him. And I think one of the things that I really paid attention to is like Dr. Kendi highlights that a lot of the times, like, these white people were so pressed to not look like they were pro-black people that they did things that sometimes went against white interests in some ways, but they ultimately were like, nah, I can't, even if my gut is telling me to do this, like end slavery or to end racism and whatever, I know looking pro-black is going to hurt me. So I'm going to still keep this here. And I know, again, you see this with Jefferson, Lincoln, all these people, they're just like, I'm not going to do anything that's going to make it seem like I'm pro-black people. Even if it's going to help, like, for example, they talk about the poor farmers that were white that were being crushed by the elite. They didn't want to do anything to help them because if it happened to help black people too and the racists saw that, it was going to be an issue. So whatever. And again, that's still stuff that we see now. So I was just like, ugh, that's exhausting. And then the last thing I wanted to just hint at was I did like the end of the book where it talked a little bit about like some of the things with like Malcolm X and the Black Power thing and even kind of diving into socialism a little bit and how black people kind of lean onto that. Now, I know there's arguments against like socialism, especially when we lean into communism and all that stuff. And so this is not a podcast where I'm going to be like, oh yeah, you know, these are reasons. Like, honestly, I don't give a shit. I just, for me, I think I will honestly say that when it comes to socialism or capitalism or communism or whatever, I think the reasons why everything gets so bad and messed up is because we're humans. Because I do think if I look at the like plain definitions of socialism and what it was kind of intended to do, I'm like, yeah, it makes sense that like not one thing is in charge of everything and like we kind of try to make it that a group of people or like the collective are in charge of things, right? And ideally, that's what a democracy, I think, was trying to do too, right? But instead, like, we're in a world now where the 1% is in charge of everything. And I do feel like it's basically like another monarchy in a way, like the things that these Puritans and whatever were trying to run away from. But the monarchy now is like the 1%ers, the white men that have all the money. And so it looks different. So I do think, like, again, there could be a justification for capitalism. There could be a justification for socialism. There could probably even be a justification for communism in some ways. But because we're humans, because we are greedy for power, because we don't do the right things, I think extremism will always happen. And that's what's the hard thing about that. And I don't know, from a Christian perspective, it is because we live in a sinful world and blah, 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 or I don't know what other religious belief, what the answer of that would be. But I do think, like, again, if we look at the crux of what some of these things stands for, you can read and you're like, oh, that's not bad. But then when you see what humans do to it, you're like, oh God, save it. So again, even in looking at our current day, like in America, capitalism in itself is not a bad thing. Having a free market isn't a bad thing. But we're like seeing it at the worst point right now where it's like being monopolized by a small group of people instead of by many people and having an opportunity to have a free market and having multiple different types of businesses, everybody having some kind of opportunity to do stuff like they used to in the past. That's not happening anymore. Now we have like Disney and all these different people, they're owning like almost everything. So eventually, like, there isn't really probably going to be like a free market anymore. It's probably just going to be another mess that eventually you might be able to be like, oh, this is just as bad as communism was, right? But again, we're not there yet. But for me, I'm like, we might be. And so, again, I think as I was reading this chapter, it was just interesting to kind of see a little bit more about like where these people like Malcolm X, Huey P. Newton, Angela Davis, Martin Luther King, like just where they were kind of coming from and trying to figure out how to navigate like fighting towards equality. And I will say I went back and forth because I like MLK am a pacifist. I don't really like to throw hands and fight and all this stuff if I don't have to. I believe in like trying to use words and like talk things out and all that stuff like he did. But then at the same time, as I keep reading about bombings and lynchings and blah, 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 I can understand why Malcolm and some of the others were like, we need to protect ourselves. We need to learn how to do some kind of self-defense because there was no like talking things out with white people and like trying to find a common ground. It's like their common ground is literally putting you in the ground, like you're dead type of thing. And so I struggle with, again, violence, but at the same time, I understood why at some point you had people like the Black Panther Party coming up and being like, we need to learn how to defend ourselves. We need to learn how to fight against police brutality and all that stuff. And it is really interesting because I know like white people have essentially deemed these people as like terrorists. But then at the same time, like white people who are like lynching people and whatever, it's like, oh no, they're like really good people. Like, so I will never understand that, especially when you read and see things that the KKK was doing or like everyday people, like in the book that I talked about before, Without Sanctuary, were doing where they were just having barbecues and hanging people. That's not terrorism, but like these people defending themselves is like the math isn't mathing. So I think for me, that's been something that as a person that is not American, I wasn't born in this country. That's something that I'm like, what the hell? Like, this makes no sense, especially the more that I read about these different parties and what they were trying to do. And the fact that Americans and the government worked so hard to just like shut it down as soon as possible because they knew it was like trying to challenge their way of racist living. I definitely am like, yeah, I can't side with this. Sorry, but not sorry. And I don't know what would have been like if these people actually live like Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale, the people that started Black Panther. I don't know if maybe they started it and it was one of those things that it started off with a good idea and it ended up going to shit because they're humans and whatever. I don't know. But again, I still think like it makes sense to some degree that they were like, we can't keep letting this happen. We can't keep letting our kids get bombed. We can't keep letting these racists get away with stuff. Because again, if we're talking about like 1619 and we're moving into like the 1960s, maybe like that's at least like almost 400 years of bullshit that they're like, yo, like we're trying our best to not fight back, but we gotta fight back at some point. And I know for me, like I can handle things here and there, but I don't think I could handle 400 years of being hurt, being persecuted, being oppressed and all that stuff. So again, the fact that it took Black people that long to finally be like, okay, it's time to throw some hands. And I know that there was other rebellions and stuff before that, but the fact that in the form of the Black Panther Party, it took them a while to get here. Again, I'm like, I understand. And then I think lastly in this section, it sucked that the reaction of Black Power movement and Malcolm X and all these people pushing and trying to change things for the community ended up into Democrats and Republicans coming up with this idea of like law and order and creating like a defense for police brutality and like mass incarceration and all this stuff. Again, it was cool to read about it and to kind of see how did we get here. But again, I was just very like disappointed because it's like for example, Clinton was one of the main users of some of this crap. And I know a lot of Black people were like, oh yeah, Clinton, he's Black. And I mean, a lot of it is because of the fact that maybe he did policies here and there that kind of helped the Black community, right? But at the same time, he had a lot of policies, including the three-strike rule, that really hurt the African-American community and really led to a lot of mass incarceration of people for, like, very minor offenses. So that was, again, hard to read about. But I will say that I enjoyed reading about Angela Davis's part in this, and because that's where she connected Malcolm X, socialism, Black Power, all connected to her section of the story. So reading a little bit about what she did in her work and her arrest and how she got out of that and was able to come up with a lot of ideas for like abolishing the prison system and all that stuff, I thought that was really cool. And I hope to eventually read more about that in the future. But I think as much as it's scary to think about a world where we don't have a prison system as bad as it is now, I think it's something that I'm like, yeah, I'm open to it. I mean, especially if it's like we're incarcerating people that are just there for minor offenses. I know there's a case for maybe serial killers trying to figure out stuff like that, or if you're really doing like violent crimes and so I get those defenses, like being like, ooh, but what about, that's fine. But the fact that we have so many people in the jail system that are not only there for minor offenses, but they're also there because they can't afford to like pay for lawyers, or they get like shitty public defenders and all that stuff, like it's like, okay, we need to have this conversation and try to see what we can do, right? And so finally, just to end, I will talk a little bit about how this book kind of challenged me and provoked me and kind of forced me to see the world a little differently. I will say, for me, my first thought or reaction was that I just felt like American politics is just exhausting. I think I brought this up before in another podcast episode, but I just feel like this book reiterated for me how exhausting it is to kind of like, it often feels like we're like patiently trying to wait for white people to kind of like wake up and kind of make a decision to like be better. But then at the same time, it's like, okay, even if they do like a slither or something, it's usually because it benefits them. And I say that not to discount the work of Black and Brown organizers, because I think a lot of this stuff really did happen because Black and Brown people have been organizing and being like, hey, you will listen to me, even if it comes at the cost of my life. Like, that's something I think throughout American history is a repeating factor, that Black and Brown people are like, we're not going to sit idly by and accept you treating us like this, right? But at the same time, there's just, again, so many times in this book where I was like, oh, yes, this is an opportunity for this white person to do the right thing. And they're like on the cusp of it. But again, because they're like, oh, this doesn't benefit me, I'm not going to do it. It's like, damn it. So I thought that was really hard. And I know, especially in the present day, that's been something I've been wrestling back and forth with too in this work of anti-racism. Because I do recognize that at the end of the day, again, yes, there are a lot of Black and Brown people organizing and doing the damn thing, but we do need white people to be in this work too. And it's like us having to constantly wait for your morality to kick in sometimes. It's like, you know, it's frustrating, right? So that was one of the things that I was like, I hate that I have to sit with this after reading this book. Because again, in the present day, I'm just watching this and it's like, you guys are still not getting it. Like, we watched a man, you know, get killed for 8 minutes, George Floyd situation. We've watched so many other ones. You guys threw up these little black squares. You guys did all these little meetings and PowerPoints and events and whatever. And you did it because it makes your companies look good, or maybe you look good for a little bit because it benefited you. But then, like, for a lot of people, as soon as the work got hard and it meant that you had to continue and do some other things, like little by little, we just watch you dwindle out, just dwindle out. And for me, who I'm just starting this work, I was like, oh, this is so frustrating. But I can't even imagine for the Black and Brown people out here now that are constantly producing and trying to do this work of anti-racism and trying to push people and trying to encourage people. I mean, I can't imagine how discouraging that must be for them, because I know, again, it's discouraging for me. So again, that's where I was just like, ugh, this is exhausting. I think the second thing that kind of stood out to me was, again, back to this idea of like uplift suasion, respectability politics, and assimilation. I was looking at this stuff, reading it, and it's like, this doesn't work, you know? So I think when I was reading this book, it just reminded me also, like, this stuff doesn't work. And I think oftentimes, as much as it is nice to celebrate Black excellence, and I will never stop doing that, I also was reminded of how important it is to remember not to use it as an argument that racism is like over, not to use it as an argument for like, oh, like if only we act like this, white people will accept us. Like, we need to not do that. I think even for me, I will say the past few years, I've even had to take it a step further. And I was like, okay, let me sit down or let me think about, what am I using to measure success? Am I looking at success in terms of what I, Neff, deem as successful, or what my values see as successful, or how God created me? Am I looking at those things and being like, this is successful? Or am I gauging my successfulness based off of like the white gaze? Because a lot of the times, I think a lot of us Black people, if we really stopped and like evaluated and thought about it, I think a lot of times we do end up accidentally measuring our success based off of the white gaze. And it comes to the cost of like our own health sometimes. It comes to the cost of our identity. And then we come to this place where we're like, who am I? You know what I mean? And I know I had to go through that process being in church spaces, being in predominantly white spaces my whole life, where I had to be like, okay, I need to step back and stop letting all of these like white noise type of things like determine who I am as a person, what's successful, all these different things, and stop and be like, okay, Neff, look at how God created you. Look at what you value. Look at what desires you have and all these different things. And let's really think about what successful looks like. So I've had to reevaluate that. And I think it's so important for all of us, Black people, people of color, to kind of stop and do that. Because unfortunately, because this world is designed and built by white people, there are some things we may not get. But it doesn't mean that you can't pursue those things. And let me explain it further by saying, for example, let's say if you want to create films, right? I think like I love like people like Issa Rae and a bunch of these Black creators. They're creating films because they love it. They're creating films for the sake of creating films and TV shows and all this stuff. And if they win Oscars and if they end up winning Emmys or whatever the heck, cool, right? But if they don't, they're still doing it. They're still loving what they're doing. And I use that as an example because Oscars and Emmys and Grammys and all those different award things are what white people use to determine success. But a lot of the times, like, you'll have like really, really, really good Black, Asian, Hispanic, all these different types of actors that are out here in these streets. And they may never get an Emmy or a Grammy or whatever. And then sometimes the most mediocre actor that's white, it's like, oh, they get it. You know what I mean? And so that's an example where it's like, if Issa Rae and all these people determine their success and their ability to be good producers of film and producers of art based off of these white accolades, then they would never actually get to where they want to be. They will never actually do what they want to do because they're busy waiting for something that may not ever happen. But because they're out here in these streets producing what they're going to produce and they're doing it for the sake of producing it, I think that's where I'm like, they're successful because they're building their brand and they're building something that they love for the sake of they love it. They're not building it for the sake of I need attention from the white gaze. And so that's where I would say for like people of color, myself included, I think it's so important for us to take the time and think about it in that way. It's like we need to figure out for ourselves what is successful and go for that and not just make it about pleasing these gringos, because we're never going to do it. Whether you're the best of the best or you're what they consider the worst of the worst, like all of us are like going to get it. There's nobody that's safe from racism, honestly. And so I know, especially, I think another thing that came up for me too is like, as a person that has this access to education and some of the other things and who has been in all these different white spaces, I think for me, I've had to be very mindful too of like, I don't want to be another Black person that was in this book that's like, oh, well, it's because of their failures that they're there. Because I think a lot of the times what we Black elitists or we Black classists or whatever you want to call it and racists have in common is like we're not taking a minute to look at what is actually going on in these communities where other Black people or other brown people are struggling. And I think between like medical apartheid in this book, it was a reminder that a lot of the times like these people have no access to education in the way that that's helpful to them. Their resources for like housing and healthcare and all these different things are being stripped from them. And instead of us taking the steps to actually help repair those things or fight to help repair those things and organize, we're sitting here saying, oh, it's because of their moral failings. Oh, it's because they're wearing bonnets outside. Oh, it's because they're welfare queens. Oh, it's because of... So we're coming up with all these different scenarios and answers that don't really actually help. Instead, it just continues to perpetuate these racist ideas that are not really helpful. They're actually more harmful than anything, right? And so for me, I think this was another thing for me where I'm like, this is a challenge for me to make sure I'm not only challenging my thoughts around that, but I'm also challenging the thoughts of other people who come up with these bullshit ideas to be like, oh, it's their failures. And it's like, no, it's society. And I will say, especially as an immigrant, that's something that I'm mindful of challenging in my own like family system, because there's times like as Haitians, like people will say stuff like, oh, well, these Black Americans, they're just lazy and they care about drugs and they do this and this and that. And I have to be like, no, you know, I have to sit and try to educate my family and challenge their racist ideas about this stuff because they don't know any better, right? Both of my parents are like a lot older and they were never in school here in the States. So there's stuff that they don't know about. And so being mindful of being like, hey, mom and dad, we're not going to use these racist tropes or stereotypes to blame these groups of people because the society has failed them. I'm very mindful of doing that. And at the end of the day, too, I say this all the time. It's not like people look at me and my family and there's not like a test that's like, oh, they're Haitian, let's treat them better, right? That doesn't exist. It's like, oh, they're Black and that's it. Like, and it's the same thing with anybody from any other country that's Black. We have to be mindful to challenge these stereotypes and these tropes that we're hearing and fight for African Americans and come alongside them and be co-conspirators with them. And not in a paternalistic, I have to save you type of way, but in a let's amplify their voices type of way. Let's organize with them type of way. And so I think for me, that's a challenge that this book has done. And then lastly, I think this book, again, it was highlighting things that I was like, oh my God, is this where this comes from? And so for me, I think the last thing I wanted to highlight is there's this guy named Daniel Patrick Monahan, who was President Johnson's assistant secretary of labor. And he came up with this book called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action. And so in this thing that he created, he takes the time to basically ramble on about how women are part of the problem of why the family is struggling in the African American community and all this stuff. And to me, again, this was a moment where I was like, is this where the shit comes from, right? And so about this, Dr. Kendi says the following. Monahan's The Negro Family, the case for national action, which had reached Johnson's desk by May 1965, statistically demonstrated that civil rights legislation over the past 10 years had not improved the living conditions of most African Americans. But then after all these anti-racist revelations about the progression of racism, Monahan had rambled into assimilationist ideas. He argued that discrimination had forced the Negro family into a matriarchal structure, which, because it is so out of line with the rest of America's society, seriously retards the progress of the group as a whole and imposes a crushing burden on the Negro male and in consequence on a great many newer women as well. Monahan ended up following E. Franklin Frazier, his main scholarly source, in judging female-headed families as inferior in sexist fashion and in judging the black family as a tangle of pathology in racist fashion. He portrayed black men as emasculated by discrimination, and since they were overburdened from assuming their societal roles as heads of households, they were more oppressed than black women. They needed, Monahan pleaded, national action. Now, again, similar to the thing that I read on the top about Jack Johnson, and this, I guess, mostly applies to black people. I was reading this and I was like, is this where the shit comes from? Because throughout my life, in this 30 years I've been alive, I keep hearing all this crap about the black man being emasculated and the woman being in charge of the house is like the fall of the black community and blase, blase, blah. And for me to read this and to hear that this came from a white person, that this racist idea is something that we're like peddling in our own community, I was like, ugh. I was not only provoked to outrage, but also I was like, we need to stop coming for black women. Because I know for me, it's frustrating as a black woman to already feel like most races don't even want to date us. They don't want to treat us with respect, blah, 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 blah. That's frustrating already. But then for me as a black woman, as part of the black community, we're usually the ones that are organizing walks. We're organizing protests. We're starting Black Lives Matter. We're starting Me Too. We're starting all these different movements, trying to raise awareness for our community. We're trying to help our community. We're trying to rebuild our community. We're trying to get even you black asses out of jail, all this stuff. And again, you're not in jail because of your own doing half the time. So that's not a slide on that. But the point is, black women are out here doing all of this stuff. And we're doing what we can do with what we're given. And for it to come back to this white man stuff of we're emasculating the community, and to know that black men are continuing this narrative, to me, I was like, yeah, we need to dead this. Because also for me, it's one thing if this thought process came from a black man's mouth and he came up with it and he felt it. Sure. I'll give you that. But for me to read that a lot of this came from a white dude that looked at our community and this is what he came up with, and then the black men are continuing to like push this crap, I had a hard time sitting with this. Like, again, I was kind of provoked to anger when I was sitting with this. So I think what I will say with this, just to end, is like, I feel like, again, black people as a community, I think we need to challenge this, because I've even seen with other black women, not only black men, we're peddling this stuff and we're trying to say, oh, it's because there's a female heading this household and this is why it's bad and blah, 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 blah. And I resent that, because I do think yes, it's good to have partners in the and any kind of relationship managing the kids. I think one person doing it is hard. But I, at the same time, I do feel like oftentimes because it's acceptable for women to be more like emotional and think about compassion and empathy and blah, 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 blah. Like we bring something to the table that's good for humanity. And I say that saying like currently look at us, we're in the middle, still in the middle of a pandemic and you men have had found time for war. You've had time to like fight over stupid things like, can we say gay in school? Are we allowed to say racism in school? Like you're finding time to fight about stuff that have nothing to do with having empathy for the fact that millions of people have died. So to me, I'm like, having women being in charge of things is not always a bad thing. I do think, again, there's strength for both genders or at this point, I know there's non-binary, so I'm not trying to say anything disrespectful of that. But I think there's a point in having different genders represented, right, in these conversations and different perspectives. So I don't think one gender necessarily is bad and the other one isn't good. But currently where we're at, because of the fact that you men are struggling because of socialization and not allowing you guys to actually express any other feelings besides anger and violence and whatever else, this is where we're at. And so again, for me to read that you Black women are being blamed because of society's failures and racism and when it's all that stuff and it's not us, I was angry reading this. And so again, Black people especially, we need to end this. Like, especially because it was a white male that came up with this. I really vote that we end this way of thinking because nobody's being emasculated. Nobody is being emasculated. And I do think we need to really redefine what manhood is. Like manhood should not be so fragile how we've made it. Like, for example, somebody being gay doesn't affect your manhood. A woman having thoughts and opinions and being able to voice them should not affect your manhood. A woman making money, even if they make more money than you, that should not affect your manhood. So I think like the fact that we're blaming Black women, especially in our community, for your manhood not being intact, like it bothers me so much. And so, again, just knowing that this white dude just put statistics together and created this is just, it made me so angry. And again, this book brought up a lot of things for me where I was like, this is where this comes from. And I would love to do more research on those things and kind of maybe I'll come back on this podcast and talk about them some more. I will see. But this one especially, I was like, we need to let this go. This and the whole thing about white women are more submissive and this is why I'm with them. Like, again, date who you want to date, love who you want to love, but you don't have to bash another race to make yourself and your partner work. Like, you just be with who you want to be with and that's it. And it's the same thing with this emasculation thing. Like, we need to address what we need to address, and it's mass incarceration, poor resources in a lot of our neighborhoods. Yes, we can address violence, but I know it also comes back to we don't have the resources, we don't have the healthcare. Those are the things we need to address in our neighborhoods. But us blaming women for the state of our neighborhoods when a lot of the times it's these women that are keeping it afloat, I can't be down with that. And I say that also recognizing that in my family, there's a bunch of strong women that have kept my family afloat. And I will not be okay ever with anybody in my family, especially a male coming through with this BS talking about some we're emasculating. We're not. Okay. Like if we're calling you into accountability, accept it. If there's something that we need to talk about, sure, we can talk about it. But for me to be a strong woman and that it feels emasculating, what? I don't understand. I really don't understand that. But whatever. That's for a different time. But at the end of the day, I know I just ranted for a few minutes on that. But at the end of the day, this book was really, really good. I do love how, I think, again, similar to the woman who wrote Medical Apartheid, Dr. Kendi just really took a lot of time and care to comb through all of these different resources and just provided us with so much information that I was just like honored to be able to sit through, and I was honored that he actually took the time and the energy to do this work. I was very proud of him because, again, reading through all of this stuff, I imagine, like, for me with the end product, it was hard. So I imagine, like, for him, just sifting through everything must have been such a challenge to also figure out how to structure this, how to get all of the information in a way that makes sense. This took a lot. And so I'm very thankful for Dr. Kendi for putting this book together. And I do encourage you guys all to go out and try to read this book, because I do think, even though a lot of this content that I share, sometimes talking about it and just reading the information can be overwhelming. It can be a lot of different things. But if we're ignoring it, if we're not talking about it, it's hard to really understand, like, how it's harmed us and why it's harming. And for us to do something different about it is almost impossible, because we are not really getting down to the root of it. And again, it's even the few things that I brought up that I was like, this is where this comes from. Like, now that I know that this is where it comes from, not only am I going to share about it, but I now know, like, why this is a racist thing, or how this was used as a racist thing. So knowing the how and the why can really equip me to really have those conversations better and invite other people to listen. So with that said, I thank you so much for listening to this podcast episode. I know it was somewhat long, but I thank you so much for listening and being here. And I hope to see you again soon. So with that said, please listen to my outro. And please, please, please rate and review me on iTunes and all the other platforms if you can. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.